I wonder, looking at this, the day the world took off, one of the things that's been said about it is that it's managed to establish, along with, I'm afraid, David Starkey, that it's possible to put across abstract ideas on television, that the growing view that television wasn't a medium in which it could put across ideas, except for the news, is rather thrown into disarray by the series. And I think it has. And I'm beginning to form a theory as to how it's done it. And I wondered whether it was a conscious aim of yours to try and put pictures and words and other things together in a way in which an audience would actually not be distracted by the pictures or think about what was being said. Were you trying to do this explicitly, and if so...
What do you mean, a sort of subliminal thing?
Well, something like that.
Hmm. I have to agree that I felt the same way, that I wasn't sure you could actually tell abstract... I think most filmmakers don't believe that television is a very good medium for giving for explaining abstract ideas, and I've certainly never done it very successfully. And so, going back to Oliver and myself, when we were doing those films about biotechnology and about genetics, the new genetics, we intentionally avoided abstract ideas and went for a story. We went for a story of one man who kind of represented the bigger picture. He was actually doing this very naughty experiment on human beings, but he was using recombinant DNA, and he was, you know, so he represented something much bigger. But that was the way we wanted to tell that story, through one person's eyes. And similarly with Jonathan Glover, it was one person's eyes, you know, taking us through almost like an essay. And I think that's the big challenge for me, was actually to try and see whether you could actually convey ideas, because there isn't really a story. I mean, the only story really is the story of the rocket and that journey, which is what you hang it off. But really, once you've gone past that first day, and even on the first day, that only represents a third of it, doesn't it? I mean, basically, you're still hanging abstract ideas off that initial one-day story. Then you're actually out there in the land of abstract ideas, and it felt very dangerous, I have to say. You know, I wasn't quite sure we could pull it off. I wasn't quite sure whether people would be interested in what this group around the table had to say, or what, you know, how the whole thing came together, whether they would accept this as a this grand scheme of going from a day to 10,000 years, which, you know, seemed nice on paper, but would it actually work? I mean, that was for me a very kind of dangerous idea, but if you could pull it off, you know, it would be quite satisfying.
But on the other hand, I mean, programs have always been made like that.
I suppose they have, yeah.
You know, I think in some ways it's just that these things have got rarer.
Yes.
I mean, I think that's what people really pointed out. It's not that
used to be things like this on television.
All the time. And in fact, programs like Horizon used to do this.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. But then the news got round that this doesn't work, so we gave them up.
Yes. I think it's an insidious thing. It's not that anybody decides that it doesn't work like that. In fact,
you were very doubtful about whether it could be done, and less of it was being done, i.e. putting abstract ideas across. Mm. Did you use any explicit techniques? I won't show this to your other companies, rivals, but...
I don't know, I mean, there was always a sense that...
We're putting you all together in one room for 2 days.
Yeah, that was actually essential. I felt that was actually much more significant than anyone at Channel 4 realised, that if you... Because if you don't have a narrative, if you don't have that storyline going through... then you need to have some kind of coherence with the group. And so that was the idea. So the story became this quest, even if the quest was slightly artificial. And probably everyone around that table knew the answer anyway, or certainly at the level that we went into it, maybe not in the finer detail. But I mean, certainly the quest, I suppose you could argue academically, was trivial, and they all knew the answer. You all knew the answer. But at the same time, I think I always believe that by actually getting together and sharing the different perspectives, you all could learn something from it. And perhaps even more importantly was actually going out into the field and seeing these different civilizations and actually trying out some of these ideas, that when you came back and shared those ideas, that it might actually produce something new. And that was the dream. I don't think it entirely worked, but I mean, I think there were some moments where it did. And when it did, I mean, that was very special, I think.
You've got to realise that like somebody like me, I think that historians sit at home and write their books, you know, and go to the library now and again and read up on Henry VIII, but I didn't think they actually sat around and discussed things. Now, that's a kind of quite a tasty idea.
Well, no,
you know.
I mean, I have to say, coming from a scientific background, I'm not a historian, so I remember several times Alan actually saying to me, you know, well, you know, just... You're looking for an answer here, and obviously there isn't one. Yeah. You can only, you know, you can just give an opinion, and there's sort of degrees of things. But I was, and I think that's quite interesting that we, most of the people in the team, well, I suppose Ian wasn't, but I think Jim Burge, Carlo, most of the team came from a scientific background, which is right, and it was actually produced by the science department.
Yeah.
So you've actually got a group of scientists trying to make a history film, right? That's what it was all about.
That was extremely effective. But I think that one thing that worked very well, and it was also thanks to Paul, was that the mix between the pictures and the sound, and the attention you took to the sound and the commentary. You remember when, who was it who died of AIDS? Derek Jarman died.
Yes.
They had a film called Blue.
Yes.
And all they did was to show a blue screen and then have his voice.
Yes.
Yes.
It was a play.
Yes. A play.
Yes.
Now, basically, in order to make television do what radio does so well, which is put ideas across, you've got to let the ideas and the words drive the process. But people will switch off if their eyes aren't being interested. But they mustn't be too interested, and they mustn't be distracted. And what I think you did brilliantly was to get the balance so that people watched the film, and it occasionally added to the strength of the words, but all the time they were actually being carried along by the ideas. So the ideas were flowing along in the commentary and in the interviews and so on, and the seminar, and the pictures just kept reinforcing it and supporting it, so you don't get the usual battle. So you might have made the screen blue and
or black
and it you could have done it like that, but this was really, and that's why I asked you the question first, techniques like putting very bad film on, I mean that's to say jumpy, blurry, those sort of things that Ian did in the first program, where you distorted the image or you slowed it down or you made it murky or you put in fog, worked so well because that's exactly what you had to do. You had to screen the eye, you had to interest it, but not interest it too much.
Realism certainly works against you, I think, in these.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, certainly.
That's a very pragmatic solution from the producer's point of view, I have to say. You can't afford 1,000 extras.
No, but it's not just that. If you actually, it's not just that though. Because if you filmed, you know, some big scene, and it was all pristine and in focus, it would not work. We could have afforded another 20 extras in China it wouldn't necessarily have worked. It has to be much more impressionistic.
Well, that's why a lot of these archaeology programs don't work, but they do try and combine realism with ideas. It just doesn't work. So I think you've actually...
But that's Paul's skill. I mean, Paul, I have to say, the interesting thing is that when Paul started work on... I was very keen that before they finished the earlier programs, for the 2 and 3, that they saw what Paul did on some of the other programs, because I knew somehow that Paul would get to the essence of what these things are about, even though I may not have realised what the essence was. But I think, what Paul does in the cutting room, I mean, it comes back to what Ian was saying. Maybe when Ian goes in there, he has the whole script sort of totally worked out. But I think even Ian would say that things change.
Paul has all the material,
and some of the most important things happen. In fact, the most important things happen when we're not in the room, and it usually happens, before you've even arrived, or some odd time during the day, when Paul actually sits down for a couple of hours and works with the film. And then comes up with some quite magical juxtaposition of images. And that, to me, is the most exciting part of filmmaking. I mean, I'll give you an example, which is at the end of the Japanese bit on programme 4, where we had this whole sequence which began with...
Yes, it was lovely. That was
the
beautiful.
Whole painting on it.
Yes.
And it was all put to music and everything. There were no words attached to the sequence, but Paul had somehow taken us from the 19th century to the 20th century in a minute 30 or something, with this wonderful images of of these geishas going out and...
Well, it was this juxtaposition of they are modern and yet they keep their traditions. Exactly. And it was just done so beautifully.
Yes, and that's the kind of thing which does happen, which is very special. And that's the secret. When you see a bit of a film like that, you know it's just pure, absolutely gold. And on one level you're totally excited, and on the other totally frightened. Because you know you've got to write some words and do the sequence justice.
Yes.
So, brilliant.
Because you see, I think if you cracked this problem, which Paul has partly and you together, it opens up a whole new vein, because there is always more and more this kind of abstract intellectual kind of thing has disappeared from television. It's been taken over by the radio. And anyone who switches on the radio, there are lots of very good programmes.
Melvin Bragg or
just chief
disappointment. I mean, what would you have liked to have done in another way or better? I mean, whether
more foreign filming.
Disappointment. Not enough country.
Yeah, not enough country.
No, I mean,
more foreign film for program one.
I think on tonight's programme, I think my excitement is to answer not your question, but my the thing that really excited me was that we could get so much out of the Nepal material. I mean, I never realised tell the whole history of civilization almost just by all the different places you took us to in Nepal, and that was extraordinary. I suppose, in terms of disappointment, I mean, I don't know, I think if I was going to do it again, I would actually leave a bit longer for the academics around the table. I think actually 2 days wasn't long enough. Mm. I think if we'd had half a day for each programme, we could have got a lot more material. I don't think...
We didn't know it would work, though.
That's we didn't know thing. It would work, and I think there was part of me that when we started filming that stuff at King's College, that I was... And I think I couldn't honestly put it higher than 50%. And I was warned by Channel 4 before we even started filming that we might actually throw the whole lot away. I was prepared to do that. That the whole lot, apart from maybe, here are, you know, a group of academics who are discussing these problems in a kind of wide shot, and that would be it. You would never actually see them discussing it. And that was the worst, on one level, that would have been the worst scenario, where we'd actually thrown the lot away. What we got was something that was much better than I expected, but could have been better still. I think we should have pushed harder for getting
Kerry
a bit more
said,
argument.
You know, some of the bits should have been redone and.
I think if we'd had more time, if Joel wasn't going back to America, all the rest of it, I think we needed more time to actually get the arguments. Because I think there were not fundamental disagreements, but there were interesting disagreements that would have been, particularly between say Christopher Cullen and.
One of the unique things you never see on television are academics arguing with each other.
No.
You never see it.
The problem is that, I mean, the kind of way that...
You're on radio.
I think particularly with particularly with history as well, because you taught that history was the way this is. And I think this was an example where we were saying that actually it's not like that.
And I think that's the problem, though. Yeah. I mean, you've hit it there, really, that the balance between so much of what maybe... Certainly when I went to school, the Industrial Revolution you take for granted as kind of knowing a basic amount about it, and therefore you can argue, you have to teach all that first before you can even have a sensible discussion.
Yeah.
And that I think was a really difficult thing, actually. Somehow satisfying people who didn't really understand what the Industrial Revolution was, and at the same time, people who did know what it was and could come to it and actually get something out of it. And so to it, because you can't really have a sensible discussion at that kind of level unless... You know some of the background of some of the story, and that I think was the most difficult thing. So I think I would have, if I could do the whole thing again, that would be the main thing I'd do again. Just getting them a longer, having a bit longer with the group, actually doing it in real time, and starting with program one, and then just taking it through gently and spending a lot longer, trying to get it. We never, for example, really had a chance to discuss Anne's myopia theory. You know, I'd have loved to have heard what everyone had to say about that, but we just didn't have time. And I think if we'd done that, then we might have got a lot more.
But it is without repeating anything, it is a, with other people in another way, it's a way which worked very well, I think, and you could do, you know.
Oh, no,
in another program.
I think it could, I mean, I think, again, it's difficult, isn't it? Because I can't imagine. I don't know what you feel, Paul. I can't imagine using a huge amount more, much more of the meeting, because then it really will become a radio program.
Yeah.
I mean, There is another kind of program that you could do, which would be a kind of radio program, which would just be, and you could have done it that way. You could have just had, for 6 weeks, and it would have been very cheap, you'd have had a camera crew for 3 days, and you just filmed the people talking, had no images at all. Mm. So, but there's a way in which that might have worked, in a way, but then it would have, obviously the audiences would have gone right down, and it wouldn't have been the same kind of thing, and you wouldn't have had the investigations in the foreign countries. But that is the way, that is another way it could have worked, I suppose, but I don't know how. But I mean,
I think the thing that surprised me about the round table meeting, and I didn't think it would work at all, I must admit, but it's similar to the radio thing again, is that you can just tune in, turn the radio on, and there's maybe a discussion going on about anything, and it's something you've never heard of, you don't understand, and you've got no knowledge to bring to it. But it can still be fascinating, even if you don't know who the characters are they're talking about. If there's enough element of interest and intrigue in the discussion, it's just like listening to a very good conversation that's going on. And if you'd have gone back and shot that a second time, you probably would have only got the same amount of usable material, because in any conversation there are good bits and there are boring bits. The bits that work, and you know, where there's a kind of spark going on. And the other interesting thing is, and I'm not sure whether it was simply because the whole thing, you know, with a group of people, as it does, takes a while to warm up and for the ice to melt and people to relax. But with the later programs, which were more abstract in their nature anyway, and where you're kind of you've got a much bigger canvas and a wider sweep, and you're not really locked down so much to individual stories or details of history. That is where the discussions work best, and some of the later material. So I think you would have still had a problem, probably especially with the first day, because that is the kind of stuff that you would expect historians to be talking about in detail anyway, and that is the kind of the more predictable sort of discussion you would get. But when you're talking about 10,000 years of history, it's something almost anyone can have an opinion
on. Yeah, kind of it's weird, because the way the series has panned out, for me the most interesting programs are happening at the end, and traditionally that's when the interest in the series wanes, you know. Not from the audience necessarily, but certainly from the press.
Well, that's happened too, though.
But that's because of the upside down structure.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a very one of the reviews. One of the reviewers, I can't remember who it was. It might have been in Time Out. Time Out, and he couldn't understand why the peculiar structure, why we'd done it backwards, and it obviously missed the point completely. Because if you'd have done it the other way around, you would have had that. It's almost that triumphal inevitability, you know. It happened here because, you know, we're England and we're the best.
Britain.
you would have had precisely that kind of program, that it was ever thus and it was ever going to be that way.
Because this is what is bound to be the case with what we see starting a week after this programme ends with Peter Jay, because that's,
it'd be interesting to compare it,
that's going forwards, and it's going to be a look teleological and inevitable, because that's how history. My last question.
I find that the book, as it were, fed back into the subsequent programmes that you worked on?
Well, most of the programmes have been pretty well worked out, apart from the last programme. Certainly the last programme, it did help.
Mm. Chapter 1, I mean, my programme, I just stole Lock, Stock and Barrel from the book. I thought that was great. I must say, it was useful. David gave me the chapter, and it was really useful.
Yeah.
Jim used a bit, I think. Didn't
he? Oh, no, he did, definitely, yeah.
And writing it, you said yourself, I think, earlier, that writing it helped you clarify the ideas.
Clarify the ideas, certainly, yes. Yes, I wish I think we're already well into program 4 for us writing a chapter, but for program 6 it certainly helped. It's such a different exercise writing a book to making a film, because it's hard to explain why it's so different. Because on one level, I mean, I think that's how people imagine that you write a film, that you actually, you know, write it like a chapter, that you put down the headings and then it all comes out that way. But in reality, it's just not like that. I mean, it's much more to do with...
It's far more pragmatic, isn't it?
It is.
You're responding to material
you've
got.
It's to do with the way someone says something, or the atmosphere in a particular place. So no matter how important, say, a scene in a pottery factory might be, if the interaction between the potter and the person interviewing the potter is no good, then you can't use it. If it turns out to be good, and you know, we use a section of that, but I mean, you know, it's how it, in terms of whether that is a big scene or a small scene, totally depends on the interaction, what you've captured there. So it, so that's the difficult thing about making a film, I think, and that is different. So you've got these other things. You've obviously got to keep the stream of logic going. You've obviously got to keep the central idea. But you've also got this other balancing act, which is making sure the whole investigation feels as if it's going on some sort of track. So even if you get into a fantastically interesting conversation with an ophthalmologist about myopia in Japan, that you could run for 20 minutes without worrying at all. You know, it's a great, if you're making the film about myopia in Japan, you actually have to cut it short in order that it fits into the grand scheme of the whole thing. Now, you have to do that to some extent in a book, but you can get away with it much more in a book than you can in a film. In a film, film's much more, I think it's much more forgiving, isn't it, really, in terms of storyline and characters and interaction. It's odd, really. And sometimes it's the most frustrating thing. Sometimes you can have the most beautiful set of images or the most beautiful sequence, like the sequence we cut with Alan in the lady's toilet outside the Kaminogata house. Well, that was a marvellous scene, and it's going to be in a film one day.
Good, but I mean, got you on film.
But how, we just could never integrate it in. But I mean, that's the kind of thing where, you know, Aim was saying that's the way I operate. Well, it is. I mean, that was something that I thought, well, God, that's just amazing, that kind of place. I never really thought of, you know, Japanese toilets in that way. Maybe we can include that. Maybe we can. As it turned out, we couldn't. Mm. We couldn't actually talk about bamboo because the bamboo scene was a great scene and we cut a whole sequence attached. But I mean, that's where sometimes you have to take these decisions. Whereas you can quite easily talk about bamboo in a chapter.
Yes.
I mean, sometimes in a film, it totally unhinges it. And there's only one solution, and it's the brutal one. You just have to.
Yes. One thing that is interesting is that, I mean, taking the sort of Japanese shoot, you actually have used far less of that, for example, than you did of the Nepalese stuff.
Yeah. Or now, China, obviously,
The point was that you know, we're in Japan. It was this was the first foreign outing, was it not?
Yes, it was, yes.
So, in a way, by the time you reached Nepal, you already knew, you know, what you were actually gathering.
Yes, yes.
But you were still at the...
Yes.
The open mind stage.
Well, again, that's the way that very much that I work. And that's fairly typical, I think, that as you go on over the process of filming...
Yeah.
That if you look at, because it's something that really alarms production managers. In the first 2 weeks, you get suddenly, you know, loads and loads of rolls back, and they're like, God, you know, they're shooting the most alarming ratios. And then gradually, you know, as the production schedule goes on, you find that the number of rolls that you're shooting actually goes down, because you do actually start to understand what works, what doesn't, what's important, what isn't.
So the quality goes up, hopefully.
You spend the same amount of time, but you're not filming quite so much.
Yes.
But I think the other thing is that you can't always predict things. Like, for example, that scene in the Osaka Castle with with the man in the vaults.
Yes.
You know, I mean, that could have turned out to be very funny, or it could have been something where you got something. As it turned out, it just turned out to be a rather embarrassing scene. Yes. There was nothing to do with it really, but throw it. We tried to incorporate it, but. You know, so sometimes you have to throw out entire scenes. Yes. It wasn't Alan's fault, it wasn't the guy, it wasn't the curator's fault.
Yes.
I feel eternally guilty that we kept that guy up really late, you know, and kept him out. Yeah. But that's the way, unfortunately, it goes sometimes. You can't.
It's an amazing thing, isn't it, when you know the history of the shot,
yes,
then you're incredibly precious about it.
Yes.
When you don't, like him,
and that's
you just wind through.
Paul just looks through these tracking shots of the samurai armor through the guy who's got. He doesn't really have any answers to why they didn't shoot weapons.
Exactly,
and, you know,
exactly.
And just
he doesn't understand this technique. You had bust a gut to get
Paul never actually says forget. He's always much nicer than that.
just hides it.
This is quite going to work, dude.
But you do need that
because you know, because I've been there.
Yes.
And I know that we kept this guy waiting. Yeah. I know the trouble we had. We tried to make it work. Although also, I have to say, deep down, you know it's not quite working. Yes. You know there's something. You know, well, you're struggling.
The place itself,
you're struggling.
You never have been able to make much of Osaka Castle, would you?
Yes, no, well, it's a rather odd place. Yeah. But then that was our fault. You know, maybe we were wrong to choose that place. But I suppose when you're in a country like Japan where you're looking for anything old, you know, you seize on anything. I mean, similarly with the whole thing in Nagasaki, you know, the whole, the Dejima, you know, that ended up being nowhere.
Yeah.
Now, why was that? Now, you could argue, well, that's because it was our first days filming in Japan with you and no one quite knew what they were doing. We also had a lot of people who didn't really speak any English and who were incredibly stilted. And the place itself, we hadn't properly recce'd, and it looked... We actually got there.
Tacky.
It was pretty difficult, you know, to actually imagine. It was hard to evoke the place.
Yes.
Whereas when you got to the Kawanagata School, I mean, I don't know about you, but I could certainly feel, you know, there was a sort of feeling about the place. You could imagine Fukuzawa being in that school. You could imagine it, you know, as a merchant's house. You could imagine it as a school. So it evoked a kind of feeling of what it might have been like.
And once you'd grab the schoolboys off the street.
Yes, exactly.
which was brilliant.
Was that one of your high points, Carlo?
Grabbing the schoolboys off the street.
Kidnapping.
Yeah.
tell us about the high points of this.
I'm just going to say I'm
going to
give the
thing. Was money offered? The thing was completely disgusting because the Japanese never been asked to do anything like that before, you know. Go way outside of school and let's nab some school children and put me in a bag.
It was incredibly lucky though because it was, what, midday on a Saturday?
Mm.
So they were all on their way home anyway.
Yeah, no.
There's
still a bit better about that.
No, it was brilliant.
Well, no, you don't go putting people in vans.
So what did you enjoy most about the series?
I don't know, in Nepal in a way, because it's something I've never ever done before. You know, hardly ever slept in a sleeping bag, never been through rivers, never climbed mountains, never slept in a mud hut, never slept near animals, never been in a pre-industrial village and all that. So that was really my high point for me, because there was just so much really, that I'd never done before.
Mm.
You know, it was great fun.
Yeah.
Mm.
There's a funny thing, you know, when you show your Russia, you know, when you have your viewing with your editor, it's the most amazing thing, because you do come back with all the stories about having to get the Japanese kids off the thing. Now, if you're really brave, what you do is you sit there and you don't say a thing with the editor, and you run the material, and you soon find out what's good and what isn't, and what he can use and what he can't, you know. But always what you do, don't you?
Yeah,
you always sort of say, "Stop there, Paul. I've got to tell you about this scene coming up.
I've got to tell you about the Chinese battle scene."
Exactly.
Before you watch any of this.
In fact, you try and colour the editor's judgment all the time, you know.
Yeah, I've got to explain what's coming up next.
Yeah, and you've got to paint this sort of lovely picture of what he's about to see before he sees it.
Yeah.
Does that then put Paul in this position?
Terrible!
Does he like a teacher, really?
Paul is.
Like handing in your essay or your work.
No,
it
is. Well, it's more like he's got to make something of it. I'll tell you, it's the most amazing. I never forget the first time, you know, working at the BBC, having to try and do this. Yeah. You're very exposed because all your mistakes and all the things you were trying to do, it didn't come off or in there. But you're still trying to hang on to all the things you thought were going to work, you know. And it's the most sobering thing because the editor's only worried about a 50-minute program he's got to make. He doesn't want to make a 90-minute rough cut. You know, including all those.
He's very frightened of that. Yeah. But you know, the worst thing you can say is, when you're making a 50-minute film, I think this could be 90 minutes.
yeah, it is. No, it's a terrible aggression.
I've never had any illusions.
I would say
the material has a life of its own.
It does.
Yeah,
it's
beyond the editor, it's beyond the director.
But it's also beyond the location you've been in. It's a very strange thing. Because you see it all in this room, at the moment in Old Street, on a little TV screen. And you know, what you don't see are all the things happening on the outside of the frame. And your memory of it is so evocative of that. That little thing, it evokes all the memories you have of being there. But if it doesn't say anything to the editor, you're knackered, because that's all you've got, you know.
And it is a kind of, it's a really sobering thing.
Small cameras.
Well, you had the cameraman.
Oh, right, yeah.
And you had the sound recordist. Yeah. And slowly, you know, they went by the wayside. So that when you were in the hall,
yeah.
all the filming was done by you.
That's called budget. It's called budget limitations.
same cleaning. this camera is telling me it needs a clean, I think. It's saying cleaning cassette.
Does it?
Oh, well, you'll probably get...
Okay, this is the question that I have. One of the things that I was always unsure about, and you're always very reassuring, was whether this reverse timescale, exponential timescale going backwards, could work. Now, you were quite confident about it, but much more so than me. Now, do you think that confidence was justified, looking back on it?
Well, it worked, so I think it was justified. I mean, there are philosophical justifications for it. There are historians who have advocated, the greatest historian of the 20th century, probably, Mark Bloch, says that you should write history both backwards and forwards. And sometimes he wrote it forwards, and sometimes he, in a famous book, for instance, he took some fields in northern France, and then he traced the history of it back through the ages. So I knew that people had done this. And also, a lot of the way I work now, it's been influenced by Sherlock Holmes and detective fiction. And the idea is that you start with the final effect, and then you work back along chains of causation. And that's just this principle. That's what works in biology, and it works in detective fiction. So why shouldn't it work on film?
I mean, it seemed like a perfectly natural thing for me, from my point of view, but then, as I say, I'm not a historian. But I still could see there were limitations to it. I mean, there were problems. And it's interesting that you said you actually thinking about trying to write the story backwards yourself, and actually when it came to writing it down, you found it quite difficult. Now, why was that?
Well, I think there it becomes one's natural instinct as a historian to write forwards. And it's come about recently. I'm writing a history of glass, a book on glass. And I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll take the 17th century, then look at the Renaissance, then look at the 13th century. And in fact, just yesterday, while thinking about it, I finally decided this wasn't the way to do it. It wouldn't work like that. So I'll have to do it forwards. I'll have to start and do an orthodox history from the beginning forwards. The great advantage, the biggest problem that you have faced, which you didn't know, when librarians are appointed, they're told that they're asked one question: how do you get rid of books? That's the big problem for librarians, getting rid of books, not getting books. And the big problem for global historians is...
Sorry.
Don't worry. The big question and the problem, and the problem that Peter Jay's got, the first question you ask someone who's trying to do a global history, which is what we were trying to do, is what would you leave out? And normally, if you go forwards, you can't leave anything out, because you start with something and then it gets wider and wider and wider.
Of course, yeah.
So you have to deal with everything. If you start and go backwards, you can choose your route backwards. And that's what we do.
So you asked me the question, what I would do differently, or how it could have been better. Let me ask you the same question.
Well, obviously the answer is it couldn't have been better. But what would I have done differently? Well, the little things. I think you might have got someone who knew something about Istanbul.
We did a pretty good job, right?
and the Ottomans, rather than me, because I felt a bit... of a fraud there. I think that some of the casting, I better not be too... I think, as Sarah was saying, the technique which you developed towards the end, which was using a very lightweight camera and going and the producer and assistant producer doing it all, worked very well, and you probably could have got much more filmed and so on, but of course this is against unions and cameramen and so on, but...
We went one stage further than that. We ended up, Sarah, actually producing and filming some of it.
Well, that's my last point.
Ah.
My The only thing you could have done better was to put my grandchildren in Australia.
We tried.
And or the last stage, which was me sitting on a log.
Well, we did look at that very seriously. That was very good, actually, yes. Very good. That was possibly the best filmed of anything in the whole series.
The log.
The log.
Okay.
I think